Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. My name is V.G. Kulkarni. Many of you know me. Some don't. The speaker knows me, that's why I'm introducing him. Madhav Nalpat is a peculiar kind of Indian scholar and a security analyst. He's a UNESCO Peace Chair Professor at Manipal University in India. Manipal is the oldest and the largest private universities in India. And I remember some 55 years ago when I was in college, going to Manipal, all that there was a newly minted undergraduate college and what pretended to be a medical college those days, all started all out of private capital and private enterprise. So since then, the place itself has grown and has got tentacles in various fields of expertise and disciplines. Professor Nalpat has been there for quite a while, and his specialty is in security matters. And if I may describe it in one word, he's the kind of person who thinks out of the box on most issues. Now, to give you an example, he's the only one, as far as I know, and when he broached this topic, I laughed it off. But then, it seems to be gaining some traction. He's an originator of a concept called Asian NATO. Now, that may raise some eyebrows here, but I'm told, I checked with him just now, hey, do you have any following? He said, you bet. Okay, so that's one. Another one, to give you another example, a proxy nuclear state right here in Asia. Now, no prizes for guessing, but he's been working on these concepts and working on security issues as they concern all of Asia, especially South and Southeast and Sino-Indian security issues. And he has chosen a topic of great interest, which he dwelt on some 6 years ago right here, across from here in the veranda at the FCC. The topic chosen this time is the threat of Islamic fundamentalism to Asia. Now, this part of Asia has been slowly exposed to Islamic fundamentalism, the good and bad of it, the rights and wrongs of it. Now, some of that will be tackled in his speech. Now, I've requested him to especially focus on something that concerns this part of the world, mainly North and Southeast Asia. And he is not the one to avoid any googlies, as we say in cricket, or probably to use an American metaphor, what do you call that, curveball or something. So any curveballs you want to throw at him on the topic, do so. He's quite capable of handling them when the time for questions and answer comes. So I give you Professor Madhav Nalpat.
Thank you, Vijay, and thank you for calling me as somebody who thinks out of the box. A lot of people think I should be in a box, and a very, very secure box at that. I'm grateful to the FCC for actually having suggested this topic, because I was going to go into that very old chestnut about Sino-Indian relations, that soap opera, but the FCC suggested the Islamic fundamentalism. And the reason why I think I like that subject is, I think Islamic fundamentalism is an issue that is going to be very much in the minds of people in China and in Hong Kong for quite some time. In the next 5 or 6 years, the kind of holiday that this region has experienced from that particular phenomenon, I think, is likely to end. And the trends are definitely pointing in that direction. In that sense, I think this is a very good subject for me to talk about, not in Kuwait, not in Riyadh, but here in Hong Kong. Now, I'm afraid I'm going to be a little discursive around this. I'm not going to be able to give you in bullet points what the problems are exactly, what the solutions are exactly, for a simple reason that it's very difficult to define the problems. It's very difficult to know if what the solutions are, if indeed there are solutions. And I'd like to begin this by saying that my reference point is 1979. That is the year when Khomeini took power in Iran. the year when there was the siege of the Makkah Mosque, and the year when the USSR, when Leonid Brezhnev decided to invade Afghanistan. Now, all these were decisions that did create a harmful impact, but equally harmful, if not more harmful, was the reaction of several individuals and several states and several major players to these decisions. The reactions to the invasion of Afghanistan, to the rise of Khomeini in Iran, and to the Makkah siege. Now, let's take Saudi Arabia, for example. Saudi Arabia has been run for a long time by the Sudairi family, that Sudairi branch of the royal family. And they are what may be called the most westernized branch of the royal family. Now, a very interesting phenomenon has taken place in Asia, and that is people who are actually, I mean, I wouldn't define westernization in superficial terms in which I'm using the word here. I think westernization is a much more in-depth analysis which goes into philosophy, which goes into various other attributes. But using westernization in the sense of being, I mean, able to go to a restaurant or enjoying a party or things like that, that definition of westernization, the more westernized the leaders are, the more, in fact, they reacted in panic mode to the situation that they saw emerging out of the this so-called Islamic fundamentalist threat. In Saudi Arabia, they went ahead with a program of giving tremendous empowerment to the most regressive elements of the Saudi clergy. It was from about 1980, 81, 82 that a lot of the codes, ways of behavior, etc., started getting very sharply tightened in Saudi Arabia. And as a result, it became almost a panic situation in which you preempt the fanatics by acting like a fanatic yourself. So that is what our friends did. You had in Pakistan a little before 79, Mr. Bhutto. Mr. Bhutto was also, quote unquote, westernized. And he is the individual who first brought in the concept of involving Sharia, of involving so-called very traditional forms of what is called Islam into the running of the state in Pakistan. If you remember, the founder of Pakistan, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, had very clearly said Pakistan should be a secular state. It should not be a state where any particular religion is given preference, but Mr. Bhutto initiated that, probably because he felt defensive that he was, quote unquote, Western. You have the same thing in Iran. I mean, I remember way back, I was with my uncle when he was a doctor in Shiraz. This was way, way back when the Shah of Iran was still in Iran, and we were watching a television program. And in the television program, we saw the Shah of Iran drinking what seemed to be not water, let's put it that way. We saw his very charming Shahbano dancing with some American diplomat or something. And all this, I mean, the sense that all this kind of images were coming in a movie theater, and these images were coming, and the audience reaction was pretty extreme to that kind of image. Now, here you have an individual who has completely dissociated from the audience, because these images would not have come on that screen if the Shah had not permitted those images to come. What I'm saying is that a lot of the people in Asia, Rajiv Gandhi in India, he introduced what's called the Muslim Women's Bill. And I would define the beginning of problems in India to date from that bill, because till that time, the Supreme Court had said that Muslim women have the same right of getting, after you divorce, of compensation from the ex-husband as any women of any other community. There was an uproar by a small section of the Muslim community to that. And as a result, Rajiv Gandhi passed the Muslim Women's Bill, I think it was in 1985. And that kind of gave those radicals who believed women had no rights, whatever they wanted. And the result today is that in India, we have an unequal system in which if you're a particular religion, then you have far less rights after divorce than if you're belonging to some other communities. Why I'm saying this is that the reactions of all these westernized, modern, progressive individuals was completely in a panic mode, and they ended up empowering the very people they claimed to be fighting against and who were definitely fighting against them. Now, of course, in the case of Saudi Arabia, the change that has taken place has been very marked from 2005 when King Abdullah has become the king of Saudi Arabia. Now, King Abdullah is not a westernized person. King Abdullah is a very traditional person with a very, very strong roots in the Bedouin culture. I don't believe he knows, for example, I mean, how to hold a glass of, of any kind of. But the reality is, it is under Abdullah in the last 5 years that Saudi Arabia has gone a considerable distance towards relaxing the restrictions that were imposed on it from 1980 onwards by far more quote-unquote westernized rulers of that country. Of course, he took over the region in 1996, but for a long time he was under the pall, the shadow, so to speak. He came into his own in 2005. Now, for example, if you're an Indian in Saudi Arabia, you can go to a home theater and hundreds of people can watch an Indian movie, which was unheard of in Saudi Arabia 6 years ago. There are many more freedoms that have now come into Saudi Arabia. Recently, for example, you had the first Indian newspaper has been allowed to be set up. In fact, for some odd reason, they invited me to inaugurate all the editions in Dharan, Jeddah, and Dammam. So I inaugurated the three editions. A lot of change has come. Why I want to say this is that let's be very clear when we discuss people that you can have a superficial westernization, a superficial modernity, and do things that are completely counter to the spirit of modernity and definitely to the ideologies and the philosophies that define the Western world, and I hope defines many other parts of the world as well. There's nothing specifically Western about many of these ideologies. I want that, to request that be there. Now, moving on to basically this ideology that got empowered since 1979, that got great strength since 1979, that got huge funding from Saudi Arabia and other places since that period, that got its military arm strengthened very, very significantly because of the reaction to the US invasion of Afghanistan. At that point in time, a conscious decision was taken to outsource the war, the jihad, to the Pakistan Army. And the Pakistan Army was very, very nervous naturally about Pashtun nationalism, because you have got a huge Pashtun lands in Pakistan that are claimed to be part of the old Pashtunistan. And that, in fact, I think in 99 or so, 98, the Durand, that particular line which was drawn, which was ceded by the King of Afghanistan to the British, should have gone back to Afghanistan, but is now, of course, part of Pakistan. So they decided that they will promote the religious fundamentalists among Pashtuns rather than Pashtun nationalists. Now, Pashtuns were a very, very moderate community till, I would say, the 1970s, 1980s. You had in Pashtunistan Buddhists, you had Sikhs, you had Hindus, you had multiple places of worship, and the Pashtuns were a very, very moderate community of people, which regrettably in some parts of that particular society is not the case now. But you had all these situations. Now, what kind of an ideology has been, in a sense, buttressed by individuals who took these wrong decisions? Now, one of the core points of this idea, and again, it is a little remarkable to me why as yet people are not challenging this ideology on the grounds of theology. Now, I'd like to say that, my mother was a Muslim, and I regard myself as being definitely at least half a Muslim, if not more. And I would say I have absolutely no problem in saying that. I go to mosques, I pray there, I go to temples, I go to churches, I pray there, and for me, as it is in the Quran, God is one, God is indivisible. So it makes no difference if I search for that in a temple or a mosque or a church. So long as I have this belief in the Almighty, then I'm going there, I'm true to that Almighty. But here what happens is that, so I'd like to use the word Wahhabi Khomeinist rather than the word Islam, because I think it is wrong for us to keep using the word Islamism and Islam and to keep using it in such a way that people who are not Wahhabi, people who are not Khomeinist, will believe that this applies to them also, and they may, in a sense, by reflex, start getting more sympathetic to these creeds. So with your permission, I'd like to say, I wouldn't like to use the word Islamic fundamentalism, it's Wahhabi, Khomeinist kind of fundamentalism. What are the main elements of this? One is a complete substitution of the word of God with the word of man. You have what is called numerous hadiths, you have numerous books, numerous texts by so-called Islamic scholars who have interpreted the Quran and who are now saying this is the version of the Quran. In almost every case, that interpretation is extremely hardline and does not have any of the escape routes, does not have any of the safety walls, does not have any of the moderating features that are very present in the Quran. Now, if you look at the Hindu religion, Hinduism is not generally considered to be a violent religion. Hindus are generally considered to be a non-violent people. But the book of the Hindus, that is the Bhagavad Gita, is full of war. The entire book is about war. You have the Mahabharata war between the Pandavas and the Kauravas, and a lot of the philosophy has been derived from that war. Now, if you were to interpret this faith as a very warlike faith in which people are always fighting each other, people are always trying to defeat each other, kill each other, I think you'd be doing an injustice to the faith. Regrettably, in the case of Islam, what has happened is a very warlike, I mean, you have the same thing in the Bible, you have the same thing in the Torah, you have in any religious book you can use to justify violence, to justify oppression, to justify terror. It depends exactly if you look at it as an entirety, or you look at parts of it, and you look at parts of it in a defined way, which is what has been done now. Now, even in the US, you will define Wahhabism as pure Islam. They want to be true to the original spirit of Islam. They want to be true to the core of Islam. I mean, for heaven's sake, this is absolutely unreal. Every Muslim would like to be true to the core of Islam. Every Muslim would like to be true to the original spirit of Islam, because after all, the word of God was revealed by Prophet Muhammad, and they would like to follow that. The reality is, it's an entirely new faith, and it substitutes the word of man for the word of God. That is, don't worry about the Quran, don't read the Quran all that much, but read our interpretations of the Quran, read our interpretations, and read what we prescribe to make you, quote unquote, a good Muslim. So, in other words, only a single line of interpretation is regarded as theologically valid, and it's surprising to me why all this time, theologically, the absurdities there, the problems there, have not been challenged more openly than they have been challenged. I mean, I don't want to digress now into what's been happening in the World Trade Center and, you know, in the Ground Zero, etc. My personal view, as someone whom I said is proud to have a Muslim mother and proud to acknowledge myself as, in a sense, partly Muslim, is that it is not something I would recommend be done there, for a simple reason that psychologically it will have a negative impact of people, of perceptions about Muslims on the part of non-Muslims in the United States. Now, the United States has not got into the crusader mold. In Europe, subliminally, like it or not, there is always a reflex of the crusader situation. That has never been there in Europe. But building that particular Cordoba house in that particular location, you are now going to transplant a little of that crusader spirit into North America, and that, I think, is going to be very unhealthy for interreligious relations in the United States. So personally, I would, my first request to the Imam would have been move it somewhere else, for a simple reason that people are not as broad-minded as you are, they're not as wise as you are, and you're going to bring in certain ways of thought and thinking which is negative. It becomes symbolic of the wrong kind of message. Of course, the second advice I would have given to him is, well, you have a lot of religious intolerance in the United States and India and various countries, but you have a lot of intolerance in the Middle East. So as a person who is fighting against intolerance, it's very important that you raise your voice against intolerance globally. You raise your voice against intolerance in the Middle East with the same force that you raise your voice against intolerance in North America. Because I think it's very important that we should remember this is a problem that concerns all of us. That if you are talking about intolerance, you have to fight intolerance wherever you find it. You cannot be geography specific in terms of intolerance. Now, I've said this many times before in relation to Kashmir. Kashmir is a state where about 400 temples have been destroyed completely, where a large section of the Pandit community has been driven away from the valley. Now, this is religious intolerance. But if you read the accounts that are coming in the newspapers or the, you know, in the newspapers edited and by which many of the people in this room are working, you will not know any of that. You will not know any about any of these temples that are being destroyed. You will not know that the so-called agitation is being conducted by 1 million out of 6 million people, and that the Shia, the Bakarwal, the Gujar, the Buddhist, the Hindu, and the Sikh have no part in it. And what they want to do is to create an exclusive state in which they have all the rights, which today, unfortunately, is there in Kashmir to a large extent. A lot of Wahhabi laws are now active in Kashmir, as they are, for example, in Malaysia. Malaysia is a country that is only 60% Muslim. But you can't buy any food in Malaysia that is not halal. So the remaining 40%, the right of them to have their own kind of food has been taken away in a way which it has not yet been in Indonesia. So my second advice would have been, please let's fight religious intolerance across the world. And there are locations in the world that are much more intolerant than the United States. And let's focus on these very bad situations also. But as I said, we are going back to this ideology. And this is an ideology that does not recognize any evil in itself and that recognizes evil in the rest of the world. Now, what is the very pernicious aspect of this ideology? The very pernicious aspect of the ideology is it seeks to create a divide in the mind of one section of the community from every other section of the community. We have seen this, for example, in the United Kingdom, where you go to particular places of worship, and they will tell you, you are different from, not that you are different, they are different, they hate you, they don't like you, so eat differently from them, in a sense, behave differently from them, talk differently from them, pull yourself away from the rest of society. Now, the only way the Wahhabis and the Khomeinists can get a grip on people is by sanitizing them from the rest of society, by preventing them from mixing and mingling with the rest of society. And the economics of today, the globalization, the coming together of different cultures, coming together of different people and religion, is a nightmare for them. So they'd like to keep them in a ghetto, so to speak. And that is a very, very important component of this. And any country that indulges in this kind of ghettoization, for example, in textbooks. Again, as I said, I'm sorry to be rambling on this. It's a very complicated subject. And you know, I normally warm up in about 30 minutes, but I'm told I can have stop in 25. But look at the Middle East. Almost all the textbooks there, in almost any subject, religion is there everywhere. Now, God is something like, you know, you mix sugar in water. The sugar is invisible. The water is sweet. Every part of the water is sweet. But the sugar is invisible. Now, God and religion has to be, in a sense, invisible in our daily lives. It is to be there and motivate our conduct. But it should not be always thrust in your face the way it is in textbooks throughout the Middle East, in textbooks in other parts of the world, unfortunately, including South Asia, including Southeast Asia, including these days, a lot of textbooks that are being specially designed for people living in Europe and North America and other locations. Again, this complete attempt to ghettoize and to segregate from other elements of society is a serious problem. Of course, the other thing is, all means you're fighting the cause of God, by definition. So by definition, anything you do in that cause is absolutely kosher, is absolutely okay. Now, if you go back to the Hindu tradition, you have what is called a creature called the Yakshi. It's like an evil spirit. Now, this evil spirit comes before you as a very attractive woman, and it charms you completely. And once you're in the clutches of this particular attractive woman, it suddenly transforms itself back into the Yakshi and becomes his evil spirit. By then it's too late. You're a goner. Now the same thing happens to these fundamentalists. Once they have complete control of you, as for example in Afghanistan, 96 to 2001, then it's too late. Once they reveal their real face to you, it's too late. But till that time, they appear before you in different guises, in different forms, all of which are very attractive and all of which are calculated to appeal. So the theory, again, what is the theory behind something like a suicide bombing or suicide attack? The theory is this belief that, as Chairman Mao said, and I hope I can redeem some of my reputation here after what Mr. Kulkarni's introduction has been by quoting Chairman Mao, a single spark lighting a prairie fire. So you have one suicide bombing, you have one killing, you have one bomb blast, the entire ummah, the entire community will then catch fire, they'll get enthused, and then they will overcome everybody else. So you may be that spark, that suicide bomb, that act of terrorism, that 9/11 may be the spark that sets the whole world alight in such a beautiful way that now then this word becomes and spreads all over. This is the kind of thing that is instilled into these people's minds. Now, as I said, some of us in the line of our activity has had to come in touch with people who have been indoctrinated in this manner, talk to them at great detail and at great length, and it's very terrifying that they all believe that they are there to change the world, that they are there to follow the word of God, and that what they do, no matter how destructive, promote some huge human cause, which is something which is almost divine in its beauty and in its effects. Now, let me now go back. Now, let me then come back to China and to the situation here. And let me come back to my region of South Asia, which is, let's come back to a country called Afghanistan. And let's forget about 1979, let's forget about Taliban, let's go back to Afghanistan in 2001, when after the US under George W. Bush decided to go into Afghanistan and change the Taliban government. Now what happened there was that southern Afghanistan was left untouched by the Northern Alliance. The group that basically took care of the Taliban were the Northern Alliance. That was a group that was kept alive by India, by Russia, and by Iran throughout the period of the Taliban. These three countries worked very closely together to support this group of people, and this group of people were fanatically anti-Taliban. They were prevented from going into southern Afghanistan because it was said that this is the Pakistan would get upset or sensitive about it. It's not incidental, it's not accidental that southern Afghanistan became the focus for the resurgence of the Taliban. That is 2001. In my view, it was a mistake. Whoever are the people who went into Kabul should have gone right up to the border of Afghanistan. They were prevented from doing that. The second occurred around 2005, when it was decided to be politically correct and have an ethnic balance in the Afghan National Army. What is an ethnic balance? Ethnic balance is the bulk of the army, about 70 to 80%, should be Pashtun. Remove the Uzbeks, remove the Tajiks, remove Hazaras, and put in Pashtuns. It's wonderfully politically correct. And it's something which our friends in the politically correct part of the world really pushed very hard. The problem was the Tajiks, Uzbeks, and Hazaras were anti-Taliban. The Pashtuns, which a particular military in that particular region said are the good Pashtuns and put forward to join the ANA, many of them were having religious ideas that are not very different from the ideas I've sketched out to you. With the result, from 2005 onwards, the Afghan National Army started getting heavily infiltrated by elements who had no confidence in the war on terror, in the sense that they did not want to win the war on terror. They did not want to win the battle against the Taliban. And they felt the best thing that can happen to Afghanistan is the Taliban come back. So when you have that kind of a mindset inside your own military, now, secondly, of course, training. You know, excellent training in terms of handling a gun, camouflage, night vision, helicopters, wonderful. But the basic training is the psychological training of the mind. The fundamental theater of conflict is the psychology and the mind. And here I would like to say that kind of psychological conditioning, that kind of psychological training was almost totally absent. With the result, the kind of motivation, the kind of mindset, the kind of views that these people internally have is completely, in a sense, out of sync with the objectives with which they are supposed to be fighting. Now, what is happening here? Now, what's happening here is that, I've come to China many times. I'd like to say very clearly, I'd like to admit at the outset, I would like to see a very good relationship between India and China. For a simple reason, these are the 2 billion plus countries in Asia. These are the two, as we called it in 2000 when we had our first conference on India-China in Manipal, the two giants of Asia. And today what is needed in the world is an international architecture that is more objective, that is more rooted in ground reality than the current architecture, which basically reflects the realities of up to the 1960s or 1970s, but definitely not the realities of the current period. If India and China were to come together to push for this kind of a change in architecture, as indeed they did briefly in Copenhagen, then the odds that this kind of thing will take place faster and more effectively is much greater than if either India or China were to attempt to do this in isolation. But we have a problem in here, and that is the problem is that in China, as in Pakistan, as in other parts of the world, the military seems to be having its own foreign policy, and the military seems to be having a lot of influence in policy towards South Asia, towards India, towards Afghanistan, towards Pakistan. Now, as I said, a lot of my work is dealing with people in uniform, and although I'm a civilian myself, I'm completely in a university, but their mindset is very different from the mindset of people out of uniform. And that is not a mindset that should uncritically be accepted in terms of determination of policy, whether it's India, the United States, or China. Now, what has happened is the whole South Asian matrix, the influence of the thinking of the military has been very profound from our point of view. And one of the mistakes that they are doing in China is, like the Americans said, we will outsource our war to Pakistan and its army. Today, in a sense, China is doing the same thing. The PLA is saying, we are going to outsource our war against Islam, against Wahhabism, Khomeinism, I would not again like to use the word Islamism, to the Pakistan army. Today, you have got a situation by which you have this Karakoram highway, you have multiple links, you have from Urumqi, all kinds of air routes to all kinds of locations in Pakistan and elsewhere. You have multiple changes taking place. And why Xinjiang? Let's talk about Ningxia. Now, in Ningxia, for example, what is happening is, if you were to analyze the number of people who are learning Arabic, I mean, from the very limited access to data that I've been given, that number is rising exponentially. Especially over the last 10 years or so, that number has risen exponentially. There's no problem in learning Arabic. But the problem is that Arabic, unfortunately, a lot of the messages that are conveyed is still in Arabic. We don't have enough Arabic software, enough Arabic messages that are moderate. The non-moderate messages are still crowding out the moderate messages, even so many years after, quote unquote, the war on terror, so many trillions of dollars spent on it, so many billions of dollars and so much of outreach diplomacy and public diplomacy and XYZ diplomacy. So the learning of Arabic becomes a way in which these ideas can be funneled into very impressionable minds. You have a large number of people who are now traveling on student exchanges to and fro. People come here, people go to those locations. Again, they are coming back with mindsets which, if they're not compatible with life in Europe, they are certainly not compatible with the life and the situation and the structure in China. I mean, they are definitely not compatible with that. Now, I mean, I'm not going to go into a realm of figures, because I'm not sure that any of us are very accurate figures. But my guess is that the number of people learning Arabic in 2010 is at least five times what it was in 2005. At least five times. So in that situation, what is happening is the number of student exchanges also is very, very large. And therefore, what's happening is this kind of a consciousness is now coming. You have the Xinjiang, you have the Uyghur. The people in Ningxia are Han. So this is now spreading in the general population, and it can create a severe problem unless it is understood that you cannot outsource your internal security to any foreign army, especially a foreign army that has got multiple problems of its own. The Pakistan army of today is not the Pakistan army of 1980. What the Pakistan army of 1980 could deliver, the Pakistan army of today cannot deliver, as NATO is finding out, and as NATO, as the Chinese are going to find out in the future. So, as I said, I don't want to go across my time limit on this. I'd only like to say that, in my view, China is following in the footsteps of the United States. The United States made severe mistakes that have had a severe blowback. And today you have the People's Republic of China making a set of mistakes which I think are likely to have a very unfortunate blowback on a country that where a billion people are trying very, very hard to raise their standard of living and to once again be a situation in which China gets back in its global sphere the same kind of prestige it had for such a long period in history. Thank you very much.
The speaker will now take questions. Please raise your hand, identify yourself and your affiliation, and we'll go from the left, or the right, or anyone. Okay. Yes, sir.
My name is Adi Desai. I'm from Lim Advisors. Thank you for the great speech. It was very informative and very useful. My question rests with what you said about the use of, like, the misperceptions about current events and misperceptions about history and how that drives people forward. You especially said something about the loudest and the most extreme voices being the most well heard. And that's happening, especially not only in Middle East, not only in India, but also in US, where you have more extreme speakers being more heard. How do you try to correct this misperception of history and current events when the more extremely and more louder speakers are the ones who get more or the biggest audiences?
Well, I'd like to say clearly that that is a question that is beyond my scope to give a good answer. But I'd like to say one or two things. One is that I think it's very important to understand that if you are spending X amount of money in arms, equipment, etc., for let us say the Afghan National Army or any other army or the Pakistan Army or whatever, you have to spend a large sums of money to ensure that the mindset is such that they use those equipment, that they have, or they're on the same page regarding objectives, they're the same page as you are regarding objectives. I think there is a huge mismatch between the mindset, the money spent on mindset, and the money spent on skill set or equipment set or whatever, and that mismatch needs to change. Secondly, hardly any attention is going into the inconsistencies in the Wahhabi worldview, even regarding the translations of the Holy Quran. Now, there are older versions of the Quran, the pre-Wahhabi versions, which are very different. I have read the Quran several times, I can tell you. And each time I've read it, it has come across to me and as a very merciful, humane book. It's always there about compassion, always there about mercy, always giving a way out, of people who make mistakes. But the versions that are there, and which is the footnotes in many of the Quran. What's very interesting is you read the Quran and you read the footnotes. You'll find the footnotes are very extreme. The footnotes are very fanatic. Now, why can't we have Qurans with different footnotes, which are, in my view, a much better fit between the original message of the Quran? We don't have it. So, I frankly don't have an answer to you, except to say that as of now, we're doing a bad job. I watched a little bit on, yesterday, on Fareed Zakaria saying that Al-Qaeda is over, this problem is over. I strongly disagree. I think this problem is not over. I think the situation is getting worse. It's incubating, and it's going to become much worse.
Hello, my name's John Morris, just a member here. I was interested to, you were saying that there's an attraction with Wahhabism. What is it about the propaganda for Wahhabism that seems to be more attractive than the moderate view of Islam? The moderate view seems to be very attractive to me. I'm an atheist, but I do find it interesting. But I'd like to know what is it about Wahhabism that seems to find such a sensitive chord with the people of Asia and the Middle East?
Well, the first thing is that everybody wants a job, right, in terms of economic hardship, and everybody wants income. You're much more assured of a job in terms of preaching. You're much more assured of a good income if you're a Wahhabi than if you're not. The amount of money that is being spent to promote Wahhabism is way higher than that is spent to promote quote-unquote moderate versions. I don't think any money is being spent, frankly. Very little money, if at all, is being spent. But there is an active funding of Wahhabi institutions which is continuing to take place even today in 2010. So we have to be very careful to understand that individuals who are superficially so modern or westernized, we have to understand that unless they act in a manner which is consistent with basic human values and basic civilizational values of equal rights to all religion, etc., then those individuals are a problem no matter how convivial they are at the lunch table. So the brief answer to you, sir, is hard cash.
That money may not run out that fast. Next question for Tom Mitchell, please.
Professor Nalapat, you were speaking earlier just up here about India's admiration and your own admiration for George Bush. In terms of the war in Iraq and its effect on Wahhabi Khomeiniist extremism. Was it a good thing or a bad thing, especially relative to what you were bemoaning about the more moderate approaches in the late 70s?
Well, I'd like to say very clearly that we love George Bush in India because he broke so many bones and bashed so many heads to get the nuclear deal passed through the nationals, through the nuclear suppliers group. We would not have got that nuclear deal passed but for the very vigorous diplomacy of President Bush. But having said that, I'd like to say that, yes, getting rid of Saddam Hussein was perfect, but what followed was a disaster. Now, you had Paul Bremer as the administrator of Iraq, and you had an Iraqi who has never seen Iraq for the last 40 years or 30 years or 25 years as the advisor. Now, when you go on television and you have a foreigner as the advisor and your own countryman who has not seen the country for 30 years as the advisor, it creates a psychological resentment in the mind. Secondly, you have as your, you know, and I'd like to say that I'm going to London on the 20th to address a conference in the Anglosphere. So I'd like to say that this is not anti-British, whatever. But the reality is that there is a colonial history which Britain has in Iraq. So by going along with the British, that colonial history was again ignited in the minds of many Iraqis, and it became much easier to get people motivated against. So what happened post-invasion was a series of disasters, and frankly, I think President Bush would have been much better advised to have done what was finally done, which is go back into the barracks. I mean, I used to go to the Pentagon fairly regularly for some time, and my advice is always that from 2004 onwards, get back into the barracks. You know, number one, go into the frontier areas and prevent infiltration, but otherwise, keep out of sight. And I think that was good advice, which is now being done by the army. And I have the same thing in Afghanistan. I would like to say very clearly that if NATO goes into the barracks in Afghanistan, it will be much better for security situation in Afghanistan than today's situation in which NATO is all over Afghanistan. So, sir, I love George W. Bush because of what he did for India. But that does not mean that one signs on to what George W. Bush did in other parts of the world.
Question here.
Thanks for your entertaining talk. My name's Dan Ryan. I'm a lawyer here in Hong Kong. You seem to be very critical of outsourcing the response to the Wahhabi Khomeiniism, both from a military perspective and an ideological perspective. And you criticize both the United States and China. I'm not sure whether I agree with the characterization that the United States was really outsourcing its military response in either Afghanistan or Iraq. And secondly, I wonder what the real alternative is for someone like China, if not to outsource. What are you really suggesting, some sort of security pact or an actual Chinese troops on the ground in those parts of the world? And what ideologically does China really have to offer that part of the world that would be as satisfying to what the Wahhabis and the Khomeinis have to offer?
Well, answer the third question first. My view is that Chinese, like the Indians, have absolutely no role, military role in Afghanistan at all. It would be a huge mistake for them to get their troops in. Today you have Chinese in uniform who are in Pakistan. You have some of them in Afghanistan. You have them handling security for various projects, some of them part-time, and that is definitely not a very, in my view, is not a decision that will promote the security of China in the future. But that's a different. So far as Pakistan is concerned, my view is it was definitely outsourced. The arms, the identification of individuals who are to fight the jihad, the arms that were, you know, which arms were to be given to them, what kind of money was to be given to them. Almost all these key tactical decisions on the ground were taken by the Pakistan army. Now, I'd like to say very clearly that in a military campaign, no matter how good your strategy, it's eventually tactics that carry the day between victory and defeat. So if you have excellent strategy, but then tactically you hand over control to some force, which does not have the same objective that you have. Now, I mean, there are conspiracy theories, for example. There's a wild conspiracy theory that the Pakistan, of course, there are sections in Pakistan that are very anti-US that would like to see NATO fail in Afghanistan.
It's no secret that there are large elements, even the military in Pakistan, that would like to see NATO fail in Afghanistan. Supposing you were a country that didn't like NATO, and you wanted to make sure NATO failed in Afghanistan, and you try and help countries to help an army that you believe is sabotaging NATO, you would do that. Now that is a conspiracy theory. But I would only like to say, I do not believe that large elements of the military in Pakistan are on the same page regarding the ultimate objectives of the war on terror. And unless psychologically they are on the same page, unless you get people at different levels on the same page, unless you can, you know, I wouldn't use the word indoctrination, but educate and motivate the troops in that way, you're making a huge mistake. And yes, it is outsourcing. Now, of course, you know, so far as Iraq is concerned, there's been no outsourcing at all. And in fact, that's one of the complaints that that I feel can be directed to the conduct of the war. So much effort was put into making sure the procurement was taken place that came by US companies, that the war became prohibitively expensive. If you look at the Vietnam War, it was an awful war, but it created a large amount of opportunities and growth throughout the region. Because there was a lot of using of the region for material and for other needs. In the case of the Iraq War, a conscious effort was made to ensure that maximum procurement is taking place from US companies. As a result, the cost of the war became prohibitive. So, sir, I wouldn't say that the Iraq War was outsourced at all. I would say Pakistan was completely outsourced. As far as China is concerned in Afghanistan, certainly the Taliban is bad news for China as it is for India.
In the spirit of not outsourcing questions, I'll give the next question to Francis.
Francis YRTHK. Why do you say that Al Qaeda is just incubating and may come back in force?
Well, I'd like to say that from the kind of studies that we have, have been there of different populations, etc., this feeling of distance between us and them is spreading very, very rapidly. The fact that now a large, there are so many visible changes of dress, behavior, customs, attitudes is one thing. But this distance is spreading a lot, with the result that the available pools of manpower for recruitment to take place is spreading a lot. Now, if you look at, Al-Qaeda, I've never in my life ever believed in something like a centralized version of Al-Qaeda. If you look at a hatred and hostility that believes that what is happening in the world today is evil, that any little terrorist action can promote the cause of quote-unquote good, then that kind of philosophy is definitely spreading very large parts of the world. And unfortunately, it's also spreading because of the education system that is there in the open in many countries in the world. Let's take Central Asia. Central Asia, the Russian education system collapsed after the Soviet Union did. By the end of the 90s, the Russian education system had completely collapsed in Central Asia. What has taken its place? What has taken its place is the education system funded by the Middle East. And that education system has put religion, what they define as religion, at the core of the education system. Now, in China, for example, I talked to my friends in China about the internal security situation here. And I personally believe that they need to be aware of the dangers of, giving too much, autonomy in terms of education, in terms of behavior, in terms of lifestyle, and that kind of thing, certain groups. And not making them realize that we are all part of a broader community. We need all of us to understand that we are part of a broader community. We cannot survive except as part of a broader community. Now today, that particular little, that 5% extra, that extra jump is not being made, with the result that what is happening is the pools are becoming larger. Now technology is also changing. So far, we have jumped ahead of technology. We have managed, through various interceptive devices, through various devices to identify, through various devices to get into computers, whatever, to keep ahead of it. But technology is changing and morphing very quickly. And technology may come in the future that makes terrorism much more easy to carry out, much less expensive to carry out. If that happens, the manpower pool is already there to carry it into effect. So that is my point.
Now, we're racing against time, so if somebody has any great urgent question, please, last one, okay. We've got two questions. One here from this gentleman here, and one on the right hand side. Keep the questions brief.
What outcomes are Mohini leadership seeking, India first?
Well, so they're seeking a global outcome, and the global outcome is that the entire world gets converted to their point of view, initially the Muslim world. Now, I'd like to say something about Khomeinism. Khomeinism is very similar to Wahhabism. Why are the Iranian mullahs so vociferously against Israel? Why are they so arming and equipping people who are so much against Israel? They believe that by fighting Israel, and that by, in their own words, if they can eliminate Israel, then they would be accepted as the version of the true faith. That is, the Islamic Ummah will then go and support them because they believe that they are the ones who have conquered Israel. So that is why the main thing is conquest of the mind of people all over. So far as India is concerned, it's very clear. If you go to the Pakistan Army, they will tell you openly. If you go to the Jamaat-e-Islami Pakistan or many of the Ahle Hadith, they will say the Mughals were ruling India before the British came. Then what happened was the British left. And today India is being ruled by a majority Hindu population. Unacceptable. We have to go back to the state of India when the Mughals ruled it. Of course, the Mughals, many of them were very moderate rulers, but these people don't think that. So far as China is concerned, as of now, there is a kind of a lull between China. There is a kind of a lack of perception. I will not call it misperception. They are not focusing on China. And China is also now very friendly with Iran, very friendly with Libya, very friendly with Syria, very friendly with Saudi Arabia, very friendly with Pakistan, very friendly all over. But ultimately, they're going to wake up to the reality that China civilizationally is as distinct from their vision as the United States is. I mean, dietary, for example, in China, you have a huge amount of pork. And even in my case, if I ask for a vegetable salad, I get it sprinkled with pork. Now, pork, even if you're not a Wahhabi, you don't like that. So very frankly, I think the Chinese are dancing on a very thin line. It's only a matter of time before these people perceive that China is civilizationally as big a threat as the West is, and they go against China as well.
The last question, please.
Thank you. My name is Christopher Howe. I'm just a member here. One of the things in your talk that I found the most interesting thing I've heard from Brett is your focus on theology, because I think you put your finger right on it. If you're being attacked by a theology and you try and address the attack without addressing the theology, you're making not only a strategic but a tactical mistake, probably a catastrophic one. The difficulty in the Western society is we live in this ghastly progressive, particularly correct environment, where even when you can see somebody is going to hit you with a sledgehammer, you're not going to stop him, you're going to line up 200 people who don't have a sledgehammer and search them all. With that sort of mindset, it seems to me that the problems that you've described, which is the first sensible analysis I think I've ever heard, is very, very difficult to deal with by those in power in the West. What intrigues me is what those in power in India and those in power in China think about what you have to say, because my experience is they tend to be a lot more sensible.
All I can say is that thank you very much, and I'm grateful to you for saying that. I just like to say that very, very clearly that so far as the West is concerned, for example, I think one being politically correct may be being tactically quite incorrect. If you're politically correct defending something that is completely incorrect from the point of view of humanity, you are not being politically correct. It's not a question of personal feelings. It's not a question of trampling on beliefs or customs or whatever. Now, it's a question of ensuring that certain rules are followed throughout the globe. In an era in which we travel throughout the globe and we move throughout the globe and we have activity throughout the globe. So one example, for example, I would like to see more imams in UK and the West come forward and try and set up, for example, centers in Middle East which are promoting different religions. I'd like to see that activity more often, because in my view, religious tolerance is not at risk so much as in the West as it is in the Middle East. So if you get money from the Middle East, from people who are basically running a very intolerant system, it's very difficult then to morally say that you're fighting intolerance. So my request is to everybody, let's look at it globally. Now, as I told you, I'm going for this Anglosphere conference. For the first time, they invited somebody from India. Winston Churchill didn't have a very high opinion of India. I mean, his concept of the Anglosphere was the United States, Canada, New Zealand, Britain, and that was it. But now, very interestingly, they've gone and they've invited somebody from India, which is a bit different from Canada or New Zealand. So that is absolutely the right way to go. And I'm sure Churchill himself, who embraced Stalin, would have embraced India very heartily if he were alive today. The reality is, you cannot think of a global situation without a global solution. And if something is, if you do something here, you have the right to demand that somebody else treat you with respect. If I am treated with respect here, then somebody from Hong Kong has the right to be treated with respect in India, and vice versa. So I do believe that we are making a fundamental errors of judgment in the way we are dealing with this problem. I do believe that we are on the way towards a pretty bad situation in the next in China, definitely 4 or 5 years later, this is going to be a very hot topic in any FCC meeting. I'm glad you're an early bird doing it now. And so far as the Indian and Chinese leadership is concerned, so far as the Chinese leadership is concerned, it is using the Russian model. The Russian model is you keep nationalities separate, you put them in a kind of a hothouse, and you try and preserve it in a kind of a museum culture. It's what we did in our Northeast for a long time. For a long time in the Northeast, we said we'll protect and preserve the culture, so to speak, and not come in contact with the rest of us. In my view, you need to ensure that people in Xinjiang, people in Ningxia, are given much more access to modern education, to modern employment, to modern science and technology, to the English language, and than people in the rest of China. You have to ensure that they are in the lead in this modernization. And you can't say that they've got a particular set of needs, they have a particular society, let's leave them alone and there'll be no problem. The reality is, today what is happening in China, especially after 9/11, there are major changes taking place within certain elements of population in China that have never taken place before. So I think this firewall is melting away, and in my view, sir, the Chinese government is doing very little about it.
Thank you, Madhav. We can't bring Churchill to Hong Kong, but before the fundamentalist problem takes on a bigger shape and size in China or in this part of the world, I hope you'll come back and give us an update on that sometime soon. But before we disperse, FCC's traditional custom says we need to give you a bit of a token.
In public?
In public, so that you can wear it for your Anglosphere conference.
Thank you.
I think it's probably a necktie or something.